Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with somebody that you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One.
Absolutely. At times early on, I questioned whether soccer would take off here in America. Knew that, you know, abroad it was the biggest sport, absolutely. And but I guess the day where I realized they came up with a video game for soccer, I was like, okay, I think we've made it.
And our guest this week is Ray Goon. He is the head women's soccer coach at Drexel University. 26 seasons with the Dragons and his squad. As we are recording this, off to the best start in program history. Ray, thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about this group this season. When I was prepping for this, I read some like previews of the conference, and they talked about you guys could kind of be a little bit of a surprise. You had talent coming back. What were your thoughts coming into this season? Did you think you had a group that was, you know, ready to really kind of punch through and make noise?
Yeah. We kind of had the same questions. If you compare or look back at last year, we had a number of overtime matches, some very close matches, one goal decisions. And so we knew we were close. Just coming into the season, every season is different, you know, different team, different makeup. But the challenge was, are we, you know, close to being a contender, or are we close to, you know, falling off the edge? And that's what we focused on, that, you know, we were close. We didn't get the results we necessarily wanted last year, but we knew we were close. And that's what we focused on, is just a little bit more to kind of push us over to the competitive edge.
How much, when you've got a group that's trying to prove something, like becoming a winner, I feel like there's only so much the coach can do. You give them the game plan, but the kids have to go out and do it. How much of learning to win is this group doing, and finding ways, like those one goal games that maybe in the past fall short, mm-hmm. now suddenly finding a way to grind it out?
Yeah, so I mean, confidence absolutely falls into play, and so we knew that was going to be a major factor, and we wanted our kids to be confident, to play confidently. So we really focused on that aspect of it, and we knew once they gained the confidence that things would start rolling. Hopefully rolling in our direction. And we didn't, you know, we really didn't focus on the results. It was more, if we do the things we're supposed to do, if we play the way we're supposed to play, the results will take care of themselves. And that's pretty much been our mindset through this beginning part of the season. And then certainly as the results started coming our way, we gained the confidence and, where we are right now.
So let's talk a little bit about overall your career with soccer. As a youngster, was it first and foremost, or were you playing whatever was going on?
Yeah, you know, just like any other kid growing up, just liked sports, played everything. Maybe not necessarily in an organized league, but, you know, in the neighborhood, you're playing football in the fall, you're playing baseball in the spring and summer, hockey, all those things. And then actually in our town, Willingboro, New Jersey, soccer started in the early 70s, and my older brothers played, and, you know, being the younger brother, just wanted to kind of follow their footsteps. So that's how I got into playing soccer, was just following my older brothers.
When does it start to become something that you're not just playing because it's going on, but because you're good at it and it's becoming a passion? Like, do you remember like the first time you got really excited for soccer's sake?
Yeah. I mean, loved all sports just to start off. But, you know, didn't necessarily have the size to play football and not necessarily the I guess skills to be really good at baseball or something like that. And you know, soccer just kind of came naturally for me. And so I started to focus a little bit more on that, just because it naturally suited me.
What position did you play?
Well, you know, it's a tricky question because when you ask that to a player, you want the player to say, wherever you need me, coach. So, kind of focused on the defensive end. I guess had this affinity to win the ball off of players and not necessarily, you know, didn't want to be known as a cherry picker or a selfish player. So just growing up, you felt if you just did the work on the defensive end, you would always be noticed and you know, the teammates would want that. So kind of focused on the defensive end, and that's where I started the trend.
That mindset, I think, is unusual in young players. Everybody wants to score the goals and, you know, get the name in the paper. Did you feel that was different as a young player? Like how you approached it was different than your buddies or teammates and stuff like that?
Maybe so, but I guess again, growing up, whatever team you're on, if you've got a goal scorer, then maybe you might start leaning towards helping the team in another way. And just growing up, the teams that I played for had those attacking players. And so I just felt to help the team better, I would focus on the defensive end.
So as you're growing up with soccer, is there a point you start realizing you're getting attention, you know, be it from college, all-star, like people want you on their team, stuff like that? Did you start to notice a point where there's a little bit of separation where you seem to be getting a little more than other people?
Not so much. In the early 70s, as I mentioned, hometown Willingboro was kind of a hotbed for soccer. So I felt that I was par with the rest of the players. So I didn't really feel that I stood out necessarily, but certainly knew I was you know, on par with the rest of the players. So fortunate that, you know, Willingboro had such a strong soccer program back in those days.
Did you watch a lot of soccer?
It was tough. It was tough to watch soccer. I think back in the day, the only soccer you would really get on a regular basis was soccer made in Germany. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the audience who was familiar with that, and it was they were delayed games, you know, from a week before. So you'd really be watching this. And being that young, I didn't know. I thought they were live matches. So it was very limited back in those days.
So eventually you go to Rutgers for college. Was Rutgers the main focus? Like, were there other schools? Is there an alternate reality where you go a different path?
Yeah, there were some other schools, but Rutgers kind of checked off all the boxes. Hometown. Just knew that playing there, my parents would be able to watch me play on a more regular basis. When I went to Rutgers, it was kind of a renaissance, if you will, in that the program was reestablishing itself. And I felt it was a good fit for me to come in and, you know, try to establish myself with a new program that was reestablishing themselves.
How's the transition to college? Like, was it a tangible wow, like that first practice from high school to college?
Yeah, I mean, they're bigger guys, you know. In high school, you're playing against certainly kids that are older than you, but, you know, exactly that, you know, they're kids. And when you get to college, you're playing with men that are older than you and have more experience. So it was definitely eye-opening when you got to that level.
How long did it take you to feel comfortable?
Well, I was fortunate because I got a lot of playing time early on, and so it felt very natural very early, and I think that kind of helped my career with that.
So Rutgers, during your career, you guys end up having a lot of success. I think you had one undefeated regular season. What are your memories of your college days, be it kind of from a win-loss performance standpoint to a teammate camaraderie standpoint. When you think about your college days, what comes rushing back?
Yeah, you know, the coach back then, Bob Riasso, his selling point was, you know, we're New Jersey's university and we're going to do it with New Jersey players. And that really resonated with the team during my time there, that we knew that we could be competitive. New Jersey was a soccer hotbed for college soccer, and we knew we could do it. So that was really something that stuck with me, as we were doing it with a lot of hometown boys, if you will.
I know you pursued pro soccer with the in the United Soccer League and with Houston. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate and kind of not fortunate in that I had the opportunity to go to Houston to extend my career. But the landscape of professional soccer at that time, you know, was not good. NASL, the pro league had just disbanded, and actually, so I was fortunate to latch on with the Houston Dynamo down in the USL, but they suspended operations that season as well. But fortunate that the Houston Dynamo decided to continue on, and so we played a number of exhibition matches throughout that summer season. But so, you know, fortunate that I was able to get that experience, but also sometimes in the back of my mind, I felt, you know, you kind of missed the boat a little bit. If I was a little bit older, I would have been able to experience some of the NASL opportunities with that league.
So were there other options? Did you think about overseas or anything like that?
Yeah, did talk to a couple players that, you know, kind of encouraged going overseas. Indoor soccer was kind of America's sport that was emerging through, you know, for soccer at the time. But again, some very limited opportunities. And that's where I didn't really see a really prospective prospect of playing soccer. That's where I started to turn my attention to coaching instead of playing.
And how would your, because the indoor game is a lot different than the outdoor, would your skill set, do you feel it would have translated? Because it's a much more offensive game for for the indoor.
Yeah, and I think it's more specialized, so specialty players with that compared to the outdoor game. And so it was still labeled soccer, but kind of in the back of my mind, it wasn't soccer. And at times, just question whether is that really the direction that I wanted to go in with that.
So you start turning your eye to coaching. What's the coaching landscape? Kind of where did you start when you kind of decided to try that?
So fortunate to have an older brother that was already in the college coaching ranks. So that's the natural step, was just to go with him. Division III men's program, SUNY New Paltz and upstate New York. And that's where I, you know, the first coaching bug bite, if you will. And then spent 2 years there and then moved on to a junior college to be a head coach. I think that's every coach's aspiration eventually, is to be a head coach. And something was just a little bit missing in there. And I think when I look back, and a big reason why I turned over to the women's side was I wanted to deal with the Division I mentality. And so nothing against the other players. The student athletes from the D3 and junior college level. But that was something that I was seeking, was more of the commitment and drive to that, because I felt that's, you know, where my experience was and I could help out the most.
Those early days, I'm curious, because this is one of the things I'm always curious. You know, you're probably 23, 24 at that time, maybe.
Yeah.
What's the dynamic? You know, I'm guessing there were some players on the D3 teams that, you know, a couple months younger, a year younger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, was it a difficult dynamic, like being in a position of power, but being so close in age to much of the roster? Or was it not really an issue?
No, not really an issue, because I just think that, you know, I guess more so with the guys than the girls. You got to prove yourself, So, you know, and I felt very confident with that. You know, I can prove myself. And then once you have that respect, it's, you know, much like the women also, they're just sponges now, and they want to learn from you. And so I was able to, in the early years, was able to demonstrate things for them. But then certainly start learning the other side of coaching in you know, the mental side as well. So
I'm curious, did that being able to demonstrate and still get out on the pitch, did that satisfy that itch to play enough? You know, or were you comfortable that the playing part was behind you? Because I know a lot of folks, maybe they get out of it, but they're still that, well, I'm still young. Well, I'm still in shape. And yeah, if something comes along, where were you with that?
Yeah. So fortunate, just growing up in the New Jersey, Philadelphia, New York area, there were a number of very, very competitive amateur leagues, if you will. You know, the Philadelphia Majors, there was the Super League in New York, and North Jersey Garden State League, very competitive teams. So kind of bounced around for the next 10 years or so in those leagues.
Did you enjoy all the aspects of coaching as you're settling in, you know, in the early years? Because I'm sure one of the things with coaching is you don't realize everything, especially when you get that first head coaching job, everything that falls into your bucket that you never thought of when you're a player or even an assistant. Like, what was that like, getting used to all the work you had to do just to get to practice, just to get to the game?
Yeah, no, I mean, again, fortunate that the places that that I was at in the early years, that the administrations and the programs were patient with that. I think they knew what my strengths were. They also knew what my weaknesses were, and they were patient with that. So while we're doing the work on the field, just a lot of help, a lot of people reaching out to help us with the off-field thing. So I was very fortunate in that, had administrative people and mentors that were patient and were willing to help out.
Do you remember the first thing you had to deal with as a coach that it never would have occurred to you that this is something you have to deal with as a coach? Like, was it a travel or somebody called and they missed a bus and you had to pick them, like, just whatever?
Yeah. You know, driving vans. Yeah. That certainly was something that was kind of new to us, new to me. And again, in your early years, you go off of your experiences. And so when things were a little different from what I would do, it seemed off to me. But then you realize that every player is different, and so you need to adapt with that. So certainly a lot of those little things in terms of, you know, maybe McDonald's is good for me, but for another player, you know, it was Burger King, and no, I don't want McDonald's. But once I saw a player, you know, play and not get his Burger King, you know, I made sure we got the Burger King the next time. So
how was it, especially when you were playing at the same time as you were coaching, was it difficult as a coach with the player? You control it, like you have the ball, you're making the move. But as a coach, you can tell the player what they should do, you can show them how to do it, but once the whistle goes, you know, you're at the water's edge there and they have to do it. Was it difficult giving up that control and kind of depending on the player to do something? Because I've talked to a lot of coaches, and that was one of the things that they struggled with, was that they're so used to having that control, but you have to release it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you know one way that works, and it worked for you, and so you're kind of sticking with that. But as you're mentioning, there becomes that development that it can be done more than one way. And the way that I would do it may not necessarily be, you know, the way another player does it, or even that another way that player is good at doing it that way. And you kind of start to learn to let loose a little bit. And it really makes you grow as a coach to figure out, you know, there's different ways to get things done.
So through these first few jobs, are you sold that soccer coach is going to be it? Like, were there were you still, I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, there's a financial aspect and a lot of these, I'm sure you're not making a ton of money. It's like getting into radio early on and people think you're, you know, were you sure this was the path that you were going to go? Were there ever doubts?
Yeah, I was, because at the end of the day, it's where I was happiest. And I knew that I was contributing. And it was, you know, a different job every day, you know. So it wasn't just going in and just doing things kind of autopilot. Different challenges, different times of the season, different, you know, whatever the different challenges are with the programs. And I enjoyed it. So I knew this is what I wanted to do.
So we talked about some of the jobs. I think you went back to Rutgers as an assistant for the women's team. And that eventually led to you coming to Philadelphia University, now Thomas Jefferson University. Kind of talk a little bit about what, how that opportunity came about to kind of get into the city.
Yeah. So going back, you know, I guess the first transition going from men to women, coaching men to women. And I was at, back for a Rutgers NCAA game and came across the women's coach for Rutgers at the time, who Charlie DeSilly, who was a, you know, local Philadelphia player, played at Temple and was coaching at Rutgers, and actually coached at the high school, at the rival high school in my town. So I knew of him, and we got to talking. He knew I was coaching. He asked how it was going, and he ironically had a position open and started talking to me and asked me if I ever considered coaching women, and told him, you know, never thought about it. So we kind of went through some discussions, and I guess ultimately the things that made me decide to take that opportunity was it was Division I, so the athlete part was there, and it was my alma mater, so that certainly helped out. And the opportunity to work with Charlie was something that I always thought about, and when that opportunity came. And I said, okay, so it's women, you know, how different can it be? But, you know, yeah, I found out some of the differences, but that was what made me move over and started me on my path with women's soccer.
What were the big differences?
Just different ways to get the message across. At the end of the day, it's still soccer. You know, the players are motivated differently. Players learn differently, and so that you learn that a little bit more. You know, with the guys, it was you could be a little more straightforward and get into them, be a little more critical of them, and then you initially for me it was tough being critical with the females, and they actually they wanted me to treat them and coach them like guys, and that took me a while for that. You know, you just, again, what kept you going was you could see that your efforts were making a difference, that, you were teaching, you could teach with that. And that certainly keeps you going. So that was, you know, the switch over. And then as you're coaching, I'm sure with any assistant coaches, you're coaching for a number of years, you start to wonder, you know, could I do this? Could I be the person in charge? Can I make the decisions? So I started thinking about, you know, moving to a head position, and that's when the opportunity at, actually, so I might date myself, but at the time it was Philadelphia Textile when I moved over with the women's program, was there for 2 years, and then Drexel University had the opportunity to move over to Drexel.
We need to take a break. We will have more with Drexel women's soccer coach Ray Goon right after this. This is One-on-One.
A Philadelphia dentist today was sentenced to 22 years in prison and fined $100,000.
This was just unbelievable.
You gotta understand the genius in Larry. Nobody was doing coke at this point.
No one could believe that this highly educated, young, handsome man was this kingpin drug dealer.
This is Wolves Among Us, the Larry Lavitt story. A documentary podcast from C13 Originals, a Cadence 13 studio. Listen now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle,
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back on One-on-One, continuing our conversation with Drexel University head women's soccer coach, Ray Goon.
You had a ton of success at then Philadelphia Textile. I think you, I have got it here, like 28-9-2. How much fun were there? I mean, it's always fun to win, but, you know, that's winning at a very high, you know, a high pace.
Yeah, it was fun. Absolutely. Maybe because of the makeup of the team. So there were a couple players that were already there that I knew of coaching through the Olympic development program in New Jersey. There were a couple players that I already knew over there. So they, you know, I give a lot of credit to the foundation that was already there and allowed me to come in and just kind of put my mark a little bit on it, but just tweak a few things. And we started rolling with some success. And again, confidence comes into play. And when the kids were you know, becoming more confident in their play, it just, again, the results were taking care of themselves.
So you're 2 years at Philly U, 94, 95-ish, right? So then how do... You then make the move to Drexel, and you were basically restarting. They were restarting the varsity program, and you were given the reins. Like, was that something that especially appealed to you to kind of be the person that puts the foundation pieces in place, or was it Division One? It's in the city. It's relatively close to home. Like, was it more just all those pieces or some combo?
Definitely. You know, the Division I aspect was a major factor. Probably the biggest challenge that I wasn't quite aware of was you're starting a brand new program from scratch, from the ground level. And so if anything, I just wasn't aware of how much work it was going to be from that level. On the soccer field, I kind of knew that it being a brand new program, but just on all the other levels that you touched on before, just the managing of a program from its grassroots level and a lot more than I thought it was going to be.
Was there there had been a varsity before, but it wasn't obviously anymore. Was there a club you could draw some early talent from? Like, what kind of was, you're starting a varsity program, but kind of what was the landscape that you were inheriting? Were there any pieces kind of in place you could pull from?
No, it was challenging. So from what I remember, what I was told, at the time, Drexel University was a very male-dominated institution, and they wanted to increase the female enrollment at Drexel. So they, from the athletic side, at the time, they started women's soccer back up. Women's crew had turned into an NCAA sport. They brought in women's track and field, which didn't really even get off the ground, mainly because we didn't have a track.
And makes it difficult.
Yeah, it makes it a little difficult, yeah. And so so to get back to that, that's, you know, athletics part was they're going to start a women's soccer program. While there was a program the previous year, there were very few remaining players that were made available. I think we kept three players, and It they helped out in terms of the acclimation for our new players. But to be honest, we joined a conference right away, and it was, it was real Division I right from the beginning. And so we really didn't have a honeymoon period. We didn't have really an adjustment period. And so that made it very challenging.
So when you take the job, where did you start? Like, what were your first few weeks? Was it recruiting? Let's get all the behind scenes things we can get in place. And, what time of year were you hired? First of all, when did you come in?
I was brought in June of 96.
To play that fall?
No. So they gave us a year.
Okay.
They gave us a year to get things together.
So where did you start?
So just continue to pick up from the recruiting trail from Philly Textile. A little bit different because, the curriculum, the majors that are offered at Philly Textile compared to Drexel were different. So made a little bit of a shift in terms of who you were pursuing simply because of that academic piece. But right away, just hit the ground running with the recruiting because I knew for all intent and purposes, you had to bring in a whole new team. So, are you going to bring in 25 freshmen? That's a question you were asking. Do I go the junior college route and bring in a couple, 2-year transfers? A lot different from today. The transfer option was not big back then. So,
was it fun? Like putting all these pieces together? Like, do you look back on it a little more romantically than maybe in the moment when you're trying to build this thing and it's crazy? Like, how do you look back at those early days?
The competitive side of me, you looked at, the on the field kind of more so. What was good about it is that you did get to experience. You had that whole experience. And several years ago, we brought back every year we have an end of year banquet to recognize the season. And we brought back that first class that I had. And it was just it was a great experience to be able to go back and talk to them. And I guess what was really great for me was that they enjoyed that experience. So that really makes you feel a lot better that, it wasn't just about the competitive aspect of it and the wins and losses. It was, we grew together those 4 years that they were there. They enjoyed it. And it was good to hear from them that they enjoyed it.
Looking back and knowing what you know now, is there anything you do differently in those early years?
A lot, right? You've been talking to my wife, right? No, absolutely. And you don't learn. You don't learn unless you make mistakes. And if you're not reevaluating yourself and replaying the tapes, then you're really not doing your job correctly. So, we learned a lot of things. I learned things as a program manager. I learned things as a coach. There's if we could go back in time, absolutely, it'd be great to do.
What was aside from getting the players, what was the biggest challenge? Because, there are so many fronts you have to, especially when you're kind of starting something, fundraising, developing. I know you were in the conference, but putting the schedule together, getting your name out there for recruiting. Like, what was the hardest front to establish?
Yeah, no doubt it was to create the culture that you wanted. And it was challenging because you didn't have the role models to help you out. So when you're bringing the players in, you're trying to create the culture that you need, whether it's the commitment level, the motivational level, all these things. And they didn't have the role models in front of them to see that. So we were both learning, the players, the student athletes, and myself. We were both learning as that time was going on, I give them a lot of credit because they stuck with it. They still stuck with it, I'm sure any coach will tell you that creating that culture, maintaining that culture, maintaining the standards that you want. And really for us in those early years, it wasn't maintaining, it was growing those standards. So there was a level of frustration with some of the early student athletes because we would do things similar to maybe a year or two ago, but we knew that still wasn't the standard that we needed. So yes, we were still progressing, we were growing, but we, you know, encouraging them to push even further was a challenge.
How long did it take? How many years did it take till you kind of felt like the program was starting to kind of find itself and the things were in place and there was enough of a foundation built, wins, losses aside, but just like kind of the program, where maybe you didn't feel like you were kind of in foundation build mode. You were more on, you know, just growing the program like any other program. How long did that take?
Yeah, it took a while. And, you know, a number of things because we couldn't control them. But we had changed conferences during my time there. We went from the American East Conference, which at the time they had the conferences rated. And in terms of women's soccer, the American East was maybe like the 16th strongest conference in the country. And we moved to the CAA, which was the 9th strongest conference. So that aspect changed. There was a changeover in the administration at Drexel, the leadership, and so that was a moving piece as well. In addition to the university was still growing. You know, at the time when I first got here, just under 5,000 students, undergraduate students, and now, you know, we're going into this 2022-23 season, and there's just under 15,000 students. So there was a lot of moving pieces with that respect. We knew when we moved to the CAA that things such as facilities weren't up to par. And so those pieces were moving as well. And so trying to keep up with all of that, with so many things, so, you know, such a dynamic environment, you're trying to figure out where you can put your foot to get some stability. And things were moving. We're moving quickly, and in a positive way, because change, you know, it was changing in a positive way. So we knew we had to kind of to manage that and endure that as our program was still building. So it took some time. You know, it wasn't like you got the magic pot of you know, money right away. But we knew each year we were increasing in everything in our resources. So while, it, you know, sure, certainly I'm sure people would wish that you got it all at once, but it wasn't like they were taking and giving away, giving and taking away. It was a steady increase of all our resources. So we were certainly grateful for that, but it was a longer process because of that.
Do you remember the first moment that you felt like the program had kind of arrived, like a win, or, you know, like, do you remember that kind of that first signature moment?
Yeah. Not necessarily just, you know, a chronological date, but we knew that we were competing against teams better. And if you kind of just went on wins and losses, then you might think, you know, you weren't really gaining any ground. But within the game itself, we knew we were competing. We knew teams were taking us more seriously, and similar to this year, the year that we really turned the corner. You know, it's not like we made the playoffs, the conference playoffs, as the last seed, and then continued to increase there. We didn't make the playoffs. I remember in 2011. Did not make the playoffs, and then you turn around in 2012, and we were the second seed. So it you know, we knew we were close again as a team, some people might think it was a surprise. You went from not even qualifying for the playoffs to being, you know, challenging for the number one seed. But we kind of knew because, again, the process on the field, we knew that our play was improving.
I'm curious, kind of same question, different track. Was there a point you're building this? Because you had done a lot of jobs early in your career. and now you've been at Drexel for 26 years. Mm-hmm. So was there a moment when it was conscious that, you know, if they'll have me, this is where I think I'm going to set up shop for a while? Or was it kind of one of those things where you kind of look around, wow, it's been 10 years already? Because, mm-hmm. you know, I think both are very, very, we could probably find people that have been in both situations.
Yeah, a little bit of both, I guess. I think when you first start off, you know, everyone has those aspirations. And for me, in my early years, you know, I always said I wanted to be the coach of the national team, you know, and I'll start here by, you know, coaching in D3 men's soccer. But as you start going on, and certainly a credit to the Drexel administration and the support we had there, you start to wonder, you know, why not here? Why can't it be here? We have the things that you need to do here to be successful. And so it starts shifting in that manner that, why not? Why not us? Why not here? And I do recall, you know, coming to that conclusion that grass may not always be greener on the other side. So why not here?
How have you changed as a coach from when you first came to Drexel to now?
Letting loose a little bit more of the reins, a little bit more, trusting your staff more. In the early years, you're the only one. You're the only full-time member of your staff. And so you're used to doing a lot of things. And then as your program grows, you know, letting go of the reins a little bit and trusting your staff, trusting your players, trusting your captains. So definitely letting go and learning from them. You know, listening to them, learning, definitely a big difference from, you know, I don't even want to just say like 10, 15 years ago, but certainly just, you know, from year to year, you can learn from your players and your staff. So that's probably the biggest change, is that listening more rather than trying to prove you know everything.
Tactically, have you changed? Like what you try to do X and O wise early on? Are you a different? I mean, I'm sure a lot of it depends on the types of players you have on the roster, but how you attack game plans and stuff like that, has it changed much?
Well, yeah, the game has changed. You know, the student athletes have changed. Back in the day, or nowadays, you know, they're stronger, more athletic players, and so the game has changed a bit. And so you definitely have to make that, you know, that kind of conversion with it. But you're absolutely right. Every team depends on what the personnel is. You know, really that dictates more so than anything of what you have, rather than this is what we're going to do.
Do you prefer practice or games? Because I think everybody assumes, well, games, that's where it's at. But I would say coaches I've talked to over the years, it's probably a split bag. The coaches that prefer the game as opposed to the practice, where you're more hands on and you can teach and you have more of an impact.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the day, depends on the week, and certainly the setup now with the way it has changed, the collegiate setting, where the push, a little bit more push and attention to student-athlete welfare, mental health, physical health. And so more time in between games allows you to spend more time in the training aspect of it. Whereas if you don't get that time to recover and train, then it does become, the games do become more the focus. So the soccer landscape has kind of, you know, it's ebbed and flowed a little bit in terms of trying to figure out what is the right combination of matches and rest period. So I think it depends on the season, depends on the format. And on some days it's the great training environment. It's what you can accomplish training. And then other times it's, this is what it's all about, this next 90 minutes, and let's work to get the result.
Favorite part of what you do?
Just paying it forward. You know, again, I said I love soccer, and to be able to pay it forward, the things that were given to me and the opportunities were given to me, and just what you've learned and being able to pass it on, passing the torch, so to speak.
And my final question, you talked early on about, you know, growing up in the 70s and the only soccer you're seeing is from Germany on tape delay. Do you ever take a step back and are you ever amazed, like, how the sport over your lifetime, the gains it's made in the U.S., and now you can find multiple matches pretty much any day of the week, almost any time of the day. I mean, it's such a stark contrast.
Yeah. Absolutely, at times early on, I questioned whether soccer would take off here in America. Knew that, you know, abroad it was the biggest sport, absolutely. And but I guess the day where I realized they came up with a video game for soccer, I was like, okay, I think we've made it.
Ray Goon, this was so much fun. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that will do it for this week's episode. Want to thank Ray Goon for being our guest this week. Ray Goon, the head women's soccer coach at Drexel University. Now, if you like this show and you want to help us out, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. Now, you can follow the show on Twitter at @OneOnOnePod. You can follow me on Twitter as well at @MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening. And be sure to check us out again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.